Welcome to KUOW Speakers Forum. I'm your host, John O'Brien. In this episode, there are many reasons to be thankful for the life and work of author Betty McDonald, as you'll find out in this talk. If you have a love-hate relationship with chickens, her bestseller, The Egg and I, will satisfy both passions. If you have children, her Mrs. Pigglewiggle series will likely delight and challenge them. And if you suffer from self-doubt, her book about finding work in the Depression, Anybody Can Do Anything, may help. The road to McDonald's remarkable success began with a short-lived marriage situated on a chicken ranch on the Olympic Peninsula and wound its way to a cabin on Vashon Island well-suited for the life of a soon-to-be-famous writer. The Egg and I sold a million copies in less than a year. In honor of McDonald's birthday on March 26, 1907, we're presenting this talk by Paula Becker. Becker is a Seattle-based writer and historian and the author of Looking for Betty McDonald, The Egg, The Plague, Mrs. Pigglewiggle, and I. She gave this talk at the Seattle Public Library on September 10th, 2016.
I'm Jody Fenton. I am the manager of special collections here in the Seattle Public Library. I met Paula many years ago and attended a number of her various lectures on local history topics. She's a regular researcher here in the Seattle Public Library, and I know that she haunts all the other repositories in our community, searching out all the details about local history. One evening, many years ago, right after we'd opened this building in 2004, Paula was up in the Seattle room, and it was later in the evening, and we happened to be talking about various research topics. And she mentioned that she was researching the life of Betty McDonald. And I remember thinking then that there was no better scholar or enthusiast for this subject. On another occasion, Paula invited me to the Vashon Island Public Library, where she was giving a talk on Betty, and showed me through a wonderful exhibit of Betty's books in just about every language on earth. I would like to particularly call out her long-standing support for our libraries. Her voice and advocacy have been critical to our success. Thank you, Paula. She does have a day job. She's a staff historian for HistoryLink.org, the free online encyclopedia of Washington state history, where her more than 300 essays cover the dance marathon craze of the 1920s and 30s, the war effort knitting on the home front during World Wars I and II, Washington's WPA-era Federal Theater Project units, and a sideshow-style baby incubator, if you haven't seen that article, now you can go look it up, that was at the Alaska-Yukon Pacific Exposition. She's the co-author of The Future Remembered, the 1962 Seattle World's Fair and its Legacy, and of the Alaska-Yukon Pacific Exposition, Washington's first World's Fair. That makes her an expert on World's Fairs. And as that expert, she is featured in the documentary films When Seattle Invented the Future, the 1962 World's Fair, which aired on PBS stations nationwide, and the Alaska-Yukon Pacific Exposition, Washington's Forgotten World's Fair, which aired on Seattle's KCTS-9, and structural engineers of the 1962 World's Fair, which she also narrated. Paula is a generous local historian and helped the Book Club of Washington locate and publish a remarkable find, Betty's first published work, a short story called Their Families, which Elliott Bay Books has for sale here today. And we have it on a very special price point today. So if you would like a copy, either the standard edition or the deluxe edition, you'll get a great deal. Well, the research is completed, the book is written, it's published, and it's here. And Paul is here to take us on a wonderful journey as she created this great work. Thank you, Paula.
Thank you, Jody. This is so thrilling to be in this place. This is a story for another day, but when Betty McDonald was sued by a Chimicum area family who felt that she had based the Monpa cattle characters in the Agony on her, one of the things she testified in court was that she had done most of the research for that book at the Seattle Public Library. So it's very appropriate that we're here today. I'm so glad to be here, and I want to thank the library and thank the Library Foundation. And I don't want this to be like an Oscars telecast where I spend a bunch of time thanking my producers, but the fact is that there are many, many, many people who I would like to thank today. Elliott Bay Books for selling the books, and Karen Maida Alman, who's been a huge, huge supporter of me and my work, and especially the Betty McDonald Project since the very beginning. So I want to talk a little bit before I start reading about the format of my book. I wasn't sure how I was going to do it originally, but the way that it ended up is that Betty's story is central to the book, and I'm kind of on the beginning and the end. The prologue and the epilogue are kind of my piece wrapped around it. And in the beginning, as I will read to you, you know, I knew a little bit about Betty McDonald, but mostly I was thrilled as I was reading her books because I had recently moved to Seattle, and she was just this woman from my neighborhood who was telling me what it looked like in the 30s and 40s. And, you know, I sort of got interested in her as a sort of time traveler at that point. So I'm going to read to you a little bit from Looking for Betty McDonald. Now, when I started this, my youngest daughter, who we just took off to Bennington, was a baby in a sling, and I didn't need reading glasses. And that's how long we've been working on this. Prologue. The house and I. Was it the house I fell for first, or was it Betty Bard McDonald, who wrote The Egg and I and Mrs. Pigglewiggle, and who described the house with such affection? According to real estate standards, Mother's 8-bedroom brown shingled house in the University District was just a modest dwelling in a respectable neighborhood near good schools and adequate for an ordinary family. To me, that night and always, the shabby house with its broad, welcoming porch, dark woodwork, cluttered dining room plate rail, large, fragrant kitchen, easy, book-filled, firelit living room, 4 elastic bedrooms, one of them always ice cold, roomy, old-fashioned bathrooms, and huge, cluttered basement represents the ultimate in charm, warmth, and luxury. The house that Betty wrote about was in Seattle, but it could have been anywhere. For her millions of readers, it was anywhere. Or rather, it was our own place, a memory we had, or wished we had. It evoked that place of shelter and acceptance we spend our lives trying to find our way back to, a home, both actual and iconic. I knew about the house because I'd recently stumbled on Betty McDonald again after a whirlwind acquaintance with her books in childhood. I was beginning to learn about Betty's world, to slip into her books, thinking and daydreaming about her life, about her family, and especially about her houses. Betty McDonald's books describe almost all of her houses and what those places meant to her. I don't really need this because the lights are bright. We'll just do that. This house in Seattle's Roosevelt neighborhood sheltered her family during the 1930s, the period described in her books, The Plague and I, and Anybody Can Do Anything. More than any of Betty's houses, I tried to picture this one. Perusing old Seattle city directories, those dusty volumes languishing in libraries and historical archives that record who lived where year by year, I came upon the listing for Bard with a jolt. 6317 15th Avenue Northeast, Seattle. I knew that house. It was 6 blocks from my own address, on a busy arterial street I drove down many times each day. Betty McDonald was almost a stranger to me that day in the library, not yet a nearly constant focus, not yet a calling. I'm skipping around a little here. It was in El Paso, Texas in 1971 that I first encountered Betty Bard McDonald on the dust jacket of a Mrs. Pigglewiggle book. I was 8 years old. The book was from my classroom's tiny library, and I had carried it in my turquoise-flowered suitcase to Grandma's house. I had been trying and failing to learn to ride my big new red bicycle, finally giving up for the day. I opened the book in Grandma's shady guest room. The book was cheering. Mrs. Pigglewiggle seemed to understand that children had complicated feelings, that doing new things well sometimes took time. She was so wise and kind that even the parents in the book sought her advice. I felt almost as if I knew her, as if we would be friends if I could visit her. I read all four of the Mrs. Pigglewiggle books as quickly as I could find them and longed for more. Mrs. Pigglewiggle's last page told me that its author, Betty McDonald, had been born in Boulder, Colorado, and had grown up in Butte, Montana, and Seattle, Washington. It was the first I'd heard of any of those places, but the name stuck with me. Washington was the state that put stickers on my sack lunch apples, grown in Washington. When I moved to Seattle 22 years later, I thought about those stickers, and I remembered that long-ago author description. Betty McDonald lived here, I thought idly sometimes. I wonder where she might have lived and what became of her. People in Seattle knew Betty's name, but many of them knew her best for writing a different book, a bestseller whose catchy title I recognized, although I'd never read it, The Egg and I. I found the book easily and started reading. "Critics are cackling over the egg and I," proclaimed a blurb on the cover. "She has a hilarious sense of the ridiculous. If you've forgotten how to laugh, this book is what the doctor ordered." The Egg and I was published on October 3, 1945, and American readers, parched for laughter after enduring World War II, instantly embraced its tart, self-deprecatory humor. The publisher, J.B. Lippincott, took note of the book's early popularity and ramped up its publicity, dedicating much of their precious war-rationed paper to feeding the presses that churned out egg, impression after impression, barely keeping up with the rising tide of national and then international demand. Before a year was up, The Egg and I had sold more than 1 million copies and was topping nonfiction bestseller lists, so it showing no sign at all of slowing down. The book was Betty's story, or a version of her story, a childhood in a warm, rowdily eccentric family, and her marriage in the 1920s to an insurance salesman turned chicken rancher named Bob, who whisked her off into the boondocks of Washington's Olympic Peninsula. There she endured the ceaseless rain and learned to hate even baby chickens. She was forced to rely on the dubious assistance of her nearest neighbors, a slapdash couple with a brood of a dozen plus children. Betty dubbed the pair Ma and Pa Kettle. Hundreds of chickens, one burst water tower, a baby, and several years later, Betty and Bob decamped to a more modern farm, one with electric power rather than kerosene lanterns, closer to Seattle. Or so the story went in The Egg and I. I read her books and was entranced by her rendering of our shared metropolis. I read the books again and again, as if hoping that reaching back into Betty's stories would let me somehow graze fingertips with her. I wanted more and more to really know, in whatever way that might be possible, the woman behind the books. I felt haunted by Betty's world and how she saw it, by her books, her face, her story. When I read what was happening behind the doors of those houses, I wondered what she hadn't said. Her world was still alive for me. I wanted to go there to know her better than I knew her from the books I had read. I wanted, maybe, to haunt her back. I became tenaciously attached to knowing her better. I thought of myself as a sort of skip tracer, trying to locate Betty and her associates like a bill collector trying to find a missing debtor. I was skip tracing the dead. I began dipping into history books and photography archives, trying to see Betty's world when the Anybody House was hers. I wrote an article about the Anybody House, time traveling the Roosevelt District with Betty McDonald for the weekly Seattle Press. I wondered frequently what that house looked like from the inside. Driving past the house, I sometimes lurked in the car, the engine idling. One summer morning in 2005, as I was parked in the alley behind the house trying to picture the kitchen, that was me, The research process, right? A woman pulled her car up beside mine and looked at me quizzically. "Do you live here?" I asked. "I'm interested in an author named Betty McDonald who lived here in the 1930s. "Oh, I know about her," the woman said. "I have a newspaper article." Her name was Tanya, and she invited me in. So that was the newspaper article I had written for the Seattle Press. And we walked through the house, and I recognized which room had been whose. And then I went into the room that would have been Betty's mother's room, Sydney's, and that was Tanya's room. And there was the Seattle Press article lying next to the bed. And I was just like, okay, it doesn't get any better than this. But actually, it did get better than that, because I got to see other houses. So I'm going to jump ahead a little bit out of the prologue, which I've skipped a lot in, and read to you a little bit about Betty's mother and the very beginning of their time in Butte, Montana. We'll read that a little bit, and then we'll look at some pictures. And unfortunately, because I'm abridging this, I'm cutting out a lot about Betty's father, Darcy, but read the book. You can fill it in. Chapter 1, The Richest Hill on Earth. Betty McDonald never saw herself as destined for greatness. Anyone taking odds on which Bard family member might achieve fame would have backed young Betsy's father, Darcy, who worked so diligently, or else her older sister, Mary, who had the boundlessly resilient ego for it. Betsy grew up in their shadows. She was shy, but shared her family's instinct to reframe life's haphazard details into story. Bard family exploits were the ingredients for these tales. Bold adventures became bolder in the telling, and what was funny became hilarious. This was the way all of the Bard siblings, even quiet Betsy, claimed membership in the family tribe. As a young woman typing away on the manuscript of her first book, The Egg and I, during the dark days of the Second World War, Betty McDonald did not know that this prodigious storytelling muscle would be her literary gold mine. Picking her way through the tale of her first marriage, Betty began with family stories, her childhood traipsing the mineral-rich western United States, her rambunctious siblings, and her parents, Darcy and Sidney Bard. Betty's parents began their married life in Butte, Montana. For the four Bard children who lived there when they were young, Butte was an outrageous place to form their first conceptions of normalcy, and it was rich with the material for story. And if any of you have ever been to Butte, you will know what I mean. It's quite a place. In March 1903, when the newly married Sidney Bard stepped off the Northern Pacific train that carried her from Boston to Butte, nearly 10,000 men labored in the mines beneath her feet. It was a raw place for an Eastern bride. Sidney had fallen in love with the serious but dashing Darcy Bard, a tall young Harvard student with jet black hair, steady gray eyes, and whiskers that were copper-hued when he let them grow. Could she have imagined, when the couple had wed secretly 3 months before, that marrying Darcy would mean years of adventure in mining camps and towns throughout the West, far from the settled, elegant future she'd been brought up to expect? Skipping a lot. Sydney's mother, aspiring to see her only daughter rise in society, had taught her to manage servants, prepare fine cuisine, and hold her own in polite company. This set of skills was not in high demand in Butte, where social classes mixed together and where all wealth was new. There, Sydney's strongest asset was her willingness. Once in the West, she pushed her sleeves up and set about making the place a home. Throughout her marriage, Sydney managed to be with Darcy under highly adverse conditions. As newlyweds using Butte as their home base, the couple moved among remote mining camps, with Darcy inspecting mines, analyzing their potential, and suggesting ways to improve yields, and Sidney keeping house, sometimes in a tent. Sidney, ever sanguine, brought happiness, family life, and deep fellowship to their marriage. She was an excellent wife by all the standards of the time. A little more than a year after she joined Darcy in Butte, Sidney was pregnant. The couple's home base was a rented cottage on West Granite Street, two blocks from the hulking red brick mansion built by the Copper King William Clark for his first wife, Catherine. By autumn 1904, Gammy, we've explained her in some of the stuff that I skipped, but that's Betty's grandmother, Darcy's mother, Gammy had joined her son and daughter-in-law in the small house. On November 21st, 1904, Sidney gave birth to a daughter, Mary Ten Eyck Bard, whose middle name honored Sidney's Dutch ancestors. 8 months later, the Reverend Slater Clay Blackenston baptized Mary at St. John's Episcopal Church. Less than 6 months after Mary's birth, Darcy was prospecting in Utah and Nevada, although Butte was still home. Having given up their first house, the family briefly rented a shingled cottage on West Copper Street, nudging the foothills of Big Butte, the weathered outcrop from which the town took its name. Darcy operated a copper mine in Ely, Nevada, helping to form first the Western Development Company and then the Butte and Ely Company. Sidney, Gammy, and baby Mary joined Darcy there, living for a few weeks on the Agee Ranch atop Spruce Mountain in Elko County, Nevada, in a very small shack, but with an air of happiness and good tolerance of the frontier conditions on the part of all concerned, according to Darcy's mining partner, who was also staying there. By early 1907, the Bards had rented a house in the Mapleton Hills neighborhood of Boulder, Colorado. Mary was two, and Sidney was pregnant again. Boulder prided itself on being a healthful, civilized, scholarly community. It was home to the University of Colorado and to a lively and extensive Chautauqua Assembly, a mass cultural movement whose proponents believed in self-improvement through education. Ringed by mining towns and camps producing gold, silver, tungsten, and coal, Boulder dedicated itself to higher culture. Sidney and Gammy spent time with Gammy's three sisters who had settled there. Sidney joined the Friday Musical Club, which gave monthly afternoon recitals. On March 26, 1907, Anne Elizabeth Campbell Bard was born. The family called her Betsy, a nickname she would use throughout her childhood. Darcy, as usual, was away on a mining trip. Betty's account of her own birth has Gammy dashing, scatterbrained, and panicky to summon a veterinarian neighbor to help. And I, of course, looked in the city directories in Boulder, and there really was a veterinarian living across the street. I was like, yay! Sydney sent the vet home, cut and tied the umbilical cord herself, and named her newborn daughter in Gammy's honor. Betsy was born into the inadvertent matriarchy created by her father's nearly constant absence. At its head was the grandmother whose name she shared. Despite Gammy's bell-like youth and delicate features, her central attribute was the core strength that fueled her steely perseverance. Then came Sidney, who had chosen adventure over security and would continue to do so, compelled first by her husband and later by the dreams, whims, needs, and demands of her children. And most important, there was Betsy's big sister, Mary. With the dogged determination and born leadership of the classic eldest child, Mary Bard would set the path for Betsy throughout her life. This sister was a force of nature, at least to her siblings. When she made a plan, and Mary always had a plan, resisting it was nearly impossible. Veering away from her sister's plan was a skill Betsy eventually learned, but seldom practiced. Whether traveling in Mary's protective wake, or pushed ahead by one of Mary's stubborn schemes, Betsy's dance with this sometimes maddening but intensely beloved sister would be her most defining relationship. The Reverend Eliezer Sibbald baptized Betsy at St. John's Episcopal Church in Boulder on May 12, 1907. So at some point, Betty McDonald shaved a year off of her age. So until recently, everybody thought she was born in 1908. And Boulder wasn't keeping birth records at that point. And Kathy Breedlaw, who we clap for, the researcher, was the one who thought to check. She knew the family was Episcopalian and figured maybe she got christened. And sure enough, in the baptismal records, she was able to locate the exact, you know, date and who had baptized her. So she wasn't born in 1908. She couldn't have been born in 1908 because her mother was pregnant with the next child, the brother at that point. So anyway, yay for research again. That's a big picture of Betty that was taken by a Life magazine photographer. It's really intimate. She's lying in her bed eating an apple, and she has a book spread out on her chest. She's wearing a nightgown. You don't see the whole nightgown, but, you know, it's like, wow. He wandered right in and took a picture. He's staying with the family. And the look on her face, I think, is really interesting and unguarded. And it's against some images on my computer, a bunch of Betty images. And then up above it is a picture from the Boulder Public Library of the house that Betty was born in, which I did get to go into. And then the little tiny picture up in the corner is Maynard Hospital, which is where Betty died. So for me, the images were a really, really important way to access the story. And I had seen pictures that I think a lot of you guys have seen, and some of them are in the book, of Betty after she got famous. Those pictures are important, but they're more available. But I was really fortunate to have access to some family pictures and other pictures. So we'll just look at those a little bit. Oh, wait. Here's my pointer. So this is... this picture is just amazing. This is in Placerville, Idaho in 1910. The family was living there when Betty's little brother, Cleve, was born. So this is Cleve. This is a little neighbor child whose name I can tell you, but I can't remember. They're in the census. This is Betty, she tells us she had blonde hair when she was little, another neighbor child, and this is Betty's older sister, Mary. And Betty writes so much about Mary in her books, and Mary as a child, and because anybody can do anything is sort of a story about Betty and Mary's adventures in the 30s. She starts that book out by setting you up with how Mary bosses her around and how that ends up getting her into all kinds of scrapes. And to see a picture of Mary at that age was just phenomenal, because she looks like somebody who would like tell you what to do, right? Already. I figured this had to be Placerville, but then my husband Barry very sweetly came along with me on a one-day trip to Placerville, Idaho. I took a lot of research trips for this book, and most of them I took by myself, but the idea of flying into Boise, getting in a rental car, driving to Placerville, which is basically now a ghost town, and trying to look around where there were all these like old mines by myself. So Barry came with me, and when we went to Placerville, I immediately recognized the hills behind. It looks exactly the same. So this story tells, or this picture tells really quite a story that augments what Betty talks about in her books. And then this is a picture that Lakeside School Archives has and let me use, which was nice. And this is a picture of St. Nicholas School, which is a girls' school. It was to train young Seattle women, daughters of important Seattle families, to give back to their community, and also how to set a gracious table and lead be the leaders in the community. So Betsy is right there. You see it. And then Mary over here in the corner. And Betty doesn't talk too much about St. Nicholas School. When she does, it's kind of dismissing later on, you know, that Mary's kept in touch with these friends from their wealthier days. But to me, this was remarkable. So this school was where, if you know Seattle's Capitol Hill, you can picture where the Harvard Exit Theater, what was the Harvard Exit Theater, is. Across the street, there's what I think of as the fake Starbucks. You know, Starbucks runs that coffee house there and make it look not like a Starbucks. That was where St. Nicholas School was originally when Betty went there. And then they moved down to next to St. Mark's. And that building down next to St. Mark's Episcopal is still there, but Betty and Mary were not students at that time. So this is a great picture, and thanks to the Lakeside Archives. Then this is a picture of Blanche, which again, you know, Blanche met Betty and Mary when Blanche and Betty were 14 years old. She was still Betsy then. And so to have this picture of Blanche at that age, and Blanche grew up very close to the house where I live now and told me all kinds of stories about my neighborhood and a lot about herself as a little girl in that neighborhood. So this was very thrilling for me to be able to bring Blanche at this age into the story. That's her graduation blurb in the Roosevelt High School Rough Rider. She was Botch, that was her nickname. This is a pretty amazing picture. I don't know how clearly you can see it, but that's Betty in the middle. And so what happened was, spoiler alert, Betty's father died very unexpectedly in 1920, and the family, before too long, was kind of unraveling financially, especially. During those years, they were still living in this big grand house in Laurelhurst, but the kids were, there was a little more of a feral thing going on from what I can understand. And so this picture was Betty and Betsy and a lot of her friends, and this was how Laurelhurst looked at this point. The house that they lived in was one of the first houses to be built in the, what became the Laurelhurst district. And so there was a lot of woods, and you know, you had to kind of bushwhack to get to the lake. So not only does this tell us about that neighborhood when she lived there, but I mean, there's also, there's this kind of wildness to this picture that I think is really amazing. This picture is, of course, Betty McDonald was the first and most important, I think, of her era ambassador of the Great Pacific Northwest to the rest of the world, and very acknowledged that she helped the tourism industry, et cetera. So here's here's Betty as a young woman, quite young woman, and she's with Margaret Bundy Callahan, who I mentioned, probably still Margaret Bundy at that point, and they're up on Mount Rainier. And I guess the glaciers are not as big anymore, so. This picture is not in the book. The other pictures we've seen so far are in the book. The quality is just not, was not good enough to reproduce, but this is something that Kathy Breedlaw found, and it's an application for employment that Betty filled out to the National Recovery Administration. And so this was when she left her first husband, and she brought her little girls to Seattle, and she was living with her mother in the Anybody Can Do Anything house in those years. You know, she describes herself, you still sort of see her as this adult, older, sophisticated Betty, even though she talks a little bit about, you know, how she was not quite that way, but that's the picture that comes across. So to see this picture of her, how she looked when she fled the farm with the little girls, and that's a really strong young woman, but it's somebody who's been through a lot already. You can see that. And yes, it's the Depression, and she's trying to get a job, but this it's amazing, I think. And this also gives us other information about the years that she was, the schools that she was at. She doesn't list everything, but anyway, lots of information in that. So this is a great picture. The woman who owns the property that was Betty's during the Egg and I, so out in Chimicum, is this wonderful woman, and she invited me to come out, and she knew some of the family members, the Bishop family, who were the ones that Betty had portrayed as the Kettle family. And so, you know, the original people are long gone, but there were still, you know, like the widow of one of the Kettle sons, and I interviewed her and interviewed these children who had lived on the property when The Egg and I was published, and their mother and their family would, like, for a dollar a carload, let you come through and look at The Egg and I property, because people were just crazy to see everything that Betty had described. They would come from Germany and England and, you know, to Chimicum. Say, where's that house Betty McDonald wrote about? So this is a picture of the Bishop family shortly after Betty left the Chimicum area. And here are the couple that she, and I know she said she didn't, but the people, she really did base Ma and Pa Kettle on this couple. So the family let me use this picture, which was spectacular. And then just to show you, here are the movie Kettles, Marjorie Maine and Percy Kilbride. And, you know, it's just interesting to, you know, look at the real people and, you know, see that. So And then this is a great picture of Betty on her Carmel Valley Ranch where she moved. She and Don bought a big property, huge property down there, and moved there toward what ended up being the end of her life. And I love it because I hadn't really seen any pictures of her down there, and also love Don. He's like so impatient, you know. I don't know what she's done to annoy him, but I just, you know, he's impatient with the whole thing. I just thought that was wonderful, and she looks really happy. And she was considering writing another book when she was ill. She told her publisher that she wanted to write a book called Too Old to Ride, which was going to be about her adventures with this particular horse. So that was pretty great to see that. So I'm going to read to you a little bit more, and then we'll have questions when I finish reading. And I'm going to read to you the part of the book that talks about Betty's switch from the back cover of the Egg and I. You're looking at the original Egg and I. When it came out, there was a little drawing by Richard Bennett, who was a Seattle and New York artist. And pretty soon, her publicist and her publisher decided she was really part of the story. So we're going to read that part, and then we'll stop for questions. Egg Dawn. The little McDonald house on Vashon clung to the bluff as if held there by incantation. Below the house was a beach, strewn by the sea with massive logs, littered with wet bark and bull kelp. Salt water and creosote-coated wood perfumed the beach, and in the house, the crackling wood stove and the ever-ready coffee pot scented the small kitchen, engendering a sense of calm, of home. In 1944, with the whole world at war, a red-haired 37-year-old woman sat in the house at the kitchen table, her fingers clacking across typewriter keys. The story she was writing would make her and her family and the house and all their houses famous. The words she wrote told a version of her life story, but they did more. When published 1 year later, they gave a world saturated with loss and destruction and death something to laugh about. They gave a world that had been holding its breath permission to exhale. Certainly when I was crouched in my kitchen on Vashon Island writing The Egg, I didn't dream that I was oozing out a bestseller, Betty reflected in an article for the Washington Alumnus. The most I hoped for was to get the damn thing finished and published so that I wouldn't have to move. Well, I have to see this. So I wouldn't have to move off the island because I had told so many people on the ferry that I was writing a book and that every publisher in New York was fighting to get it. In interviews and at book signings, Betty was endlessly asked how Egg was hatched. The minutiae of the book's creation, the war in Europe and Japan still raging, rain lashing the windows of the little house, dawn rising early to muddle down the muddy path from home to ferry dock bound for work, Anne and Joan coaxed out the door to school, another cup of coffee poured, another cigarette lit, and gratefully inhaled, and finally settling at the typewriter. Eventually faded, smoothed into something honed and easily recounted. Betty unfailingly gave credit to her sister Mary for needling, encouraging, and prodding the book into existence. Are you going to spend all your life washing your sheets by hand, or are you going to make $50,000 a year writing? Mary supposedly asked. Betty sent Brandt and Brandt, again, we're skipping a little here. Brandt and Brandt was the most important literary agency in New York, so it was like a lot of chutzpah to send it to them. And there's a backstory there. But Betty sent Brandt and Brandt her detailed outline of The Egg and I in February 1944, telling them that the manuscript was nearly finished and that she also had a draft of a book about her time in Furland, that's the tuberculosis sanatorium where she was treated, and that she'd completed 8 Mrs. Pigglewiggle stories. She later joked, "In my eagerness to prove that I wasn't a stinking old one-book author, I made it sound a little as though we had to wade through old manuscripts to go from room to room in our log house, and that I was a veritable artesian well of the written word." Royalty checks soon brought in far more than the book's $500 advance. Betty's first splurge was to install a cesspool on the Vashon property. The house was needed a cesspool. Her second was to purchase a beaver coat and hat. I look simply exquisite in same, but as it has been a long, long time since I have bought myself anything, and as I never expected to have anything in fur unless I trapped and skinned it myself, I am quite shaky, she wrote to her literary agent, Bernice Baumgarten. Being suddenly flush with cash was a dizzying sensation. Immediately after the book was published, Lippincott told Betty, that was her publisher, that over 6 days she had earned $25,000 in royalties. Imagine $25,000 in 6 days, Betty wrote Nora Flannery, one of her Furland roommates. Best's, which was a Seattle department store, who wouldn't even let me pay cash in their store last Christmas, are imploring me to open an account. And Frederick and Nelson, instead of holding a conference of the entire store every time I charge a handkerchief? Okay, anything. I don't give a damn for the fame. It is the freedom from flinching when the phone rings, the ability to stare rudely at credit managers, which thrills me. Lippincott threw its publicity budget behind the book, which continued to prosper. The Egg and I reached the number one position on the New York Times nonfiction bestseller list on December 23, 1945, and remained there for 43 weeks. It remained in the top five positions for 7 more months. Although published late in the year, The Egg and I was the 8th on the Publishers Weekly nonfiction bestseller list for 1945. In 1946, it topped the list. The next year, Betty's book made the list again, this time at number 7. This 3-year domination was as remarkable then as it would be today. In the original publication, the front of the dust jacket featured a woodcut of a farm scene by Richard Bennett, with Betty's smiling photograph on the back. In all its advertising, however, Lippincott was using Betty's face to promote the book, a strategy Macmillan Publishing had implemented in its 1944 best-selling novel, Forever Amber, which featured a glamorous headshot of its attractive author, Kathleen Windsor, on the back cover. You must admit that you look like you're having fun, Lippincott's advertising director, J.A. Mack McCann, wrote to Betty about her expression in the photo. Heaven knows that these last few years have been bare enough of laughs, and it's about time someone like you came through with an antidote to the general depression of the war period. The Egg and I used humor and nostalgia as tools for moving on. And like her book, something about Betty's photograph gave readers permission to laugh again. After only a few months, Lippincott moved Betty's appealing headshot from the back cover to the front, ditching Bennett's art. For readers, the merry pinup girl author and the yarn she spun were indivisible. From this point on, Egg branded Betty and Betty branded Egg. On January 22, 1946, The Egg and I sold 8,000 copies in a single day. So I'm going to stop with that. There's much, much, much more. We can bring the lights up. And I'm ready to take some questions. You want to help, Barry?
I think several years ago, there was an article in the Seattle Times,
yes,
based on a conversation with her daughter, Joan, and her daughter was quoted saying, I have every letter my mother ever wrote me. They could be published. They were hysterically funny.
Yes.
So is anything happening on that front?
Yeah. You know, I was lucky enough to have access to that correspondence, and it's in a safe place now, and eventually it's going to become available to researchers. So that's a great question. She was a hysterical letter writer. And, you know, I wondered as I was working on the book, you know, how much the voice you hear in the books was that editorial. Her literary agent was a wonderful editor. And then when I read the letters, I was like, nope, that's Betty, because it really comes through. So good question. Anybody else?
So I will read the book.
Okay.
But I'm curious, so which came first, The Egg and I or Mrs. Pickle Wiggle? Wait, or did they come at the same time?
Say that again. Which came first, the egg and I, or what?
Mrs. Pigglewiggle.
Oh, yeah. So the Mrs. Pigglewiggle stories, that's a very good question. The Mrs. Pigglewiggle stories grew out of stories that Betty told her daughters, Anne and Joan, and then later her nieces and nephews and friends who came to the house. And my sense is that the Mrs. Pigglewiggle stories reflect very purely the way that Betty's mind worked, the kind of absurdity and humor, and Betty loved children, and so she had already written down a number of Mrs. Pigglewiggle stories. She was trying to become a published author for about 6 or 7 years before The Egg and I, and she, you know, had sent things out, and they came back. But the first book that was published was The Egg and I, and her publisher, Lippincott, had actually rejected the Mrs. Pigglewiggle book, so had about 8 other publishers. They didn't get the kind of what we now think of as maybe magical realism, you know? And then when The Egg and I started going bananas, Lippincott was like, give it back, give it back, give it back, give it back. And they got the manuscript back and brought it back with no changes, virtually nothing. So, yes.
My follow-up question is, were the Mrs. Pigglewiggle books maybe not as popular, but super popular?
Well, The Egg and I has never been out of print since it was published in 1945. There was a period when The Egg and I was harder to get, but even though Lippincott turned into Random House, turned into HarperCollins, the publishing industry has gone through huge changes, but that book has remained on the list or the backlist of whoever that publisher, whoever owned that stuff. So the Mrs. Pigglewiggle books, I don't think they've ever really been out of print. They may have been out of print briefly, but they've pretty much consistently stayed in print. So I would say, in terms of longevity, the Egg and I is read more by people, you know, now as nostalgically, although it's still hysterical and makes people laugh. The Mrs. Pigglewiggle books are new to each generation of readers and still resonate for them. So both very popular. Yes. Hi, Kathleen.
Speaking of the Mrs. Pigglewiggle books, I think I heard something on NPR this morning that some people are updating or modernizing
Yes.
for today's
Yeah.
kids. Do you?
There was a great NPR story on this just the other day. So there's been two modern takes on Mrs. Pigglewiggle. In 2007, Betty's older daughter, Anne, took one Mrs. Pigglewiggle story that she had, which Betty had left to her, and she used that as the first chapter in a book, and then later wrote the other chapters herself, and that was Happy Birthday, Mrs. Pigglewiggle, which is for sale here today. And then just a couple of days ago, a new book, which is called Missy Pigglewiggle, was published, and it's co-written by a quite well-known young adult author and Betty's great-granddaughter, so Anne's granddaughter, Annie Parnell. And I just read it the other day. It's really fun. You know, if you like Mrs. Pigglewiggle, you probably want to read them all, but it's great, and I was really glad NPR paid attention to it. So,
thank you. My husband's probably going to kill me, but Betty wrote... She used family members in her book, and this is little Stevie in the Interrupters story, which is very true. From
I was just going to say maybe she had fictionalized the Interrupting Steve. What do you think?
Yeah. And it was in the Mrs. Pigglewiggle's Magic, and his brother, Chris, was the bad table manners person, and there was Darcy was... another cousin was yeah. also in those.
It's very delightful to go through those books and see all the family member names that she uses, and you know, she even uses, like, you know, if you've gotten as deep as I am, you know, like some of the best friends of some of the nieces and nephews, and I'm like, oh, they're so and so. But that's a really fun thing. And Betty loved children. She loved to spend time with her nieces and nephews. She complains a lot about how people dump their kids on her all the time, and so she can't get writing done, but you know she was inspired for those Mrs. Pigglewiggle books by all the time that she spent with young people. So thank you for sharing that. I hope you don't get mad at her, Steve. Steve shared a story with me that I actually mention at the end of the book, which is that Betty had him and his brother convinced that the cliff behind the Vashon house was salted with diamonds. And so they spent a lot of time digging, trying to find those diamonds. Did you ever find any?
We never found
It's not too late. Anybody else?
Back in 2001, there was Betty McDonald days at Vashon Island, and at the time, someone said that there was a storage locker in Carmel that was unopened, and they were going to look into it. Did it exist, and did you get to see the stuff?
Yeah, well, that's the materials that I was talking about. You know, Betty died here in Seattle, but she and Don were living in Carmel at the time, and Don just basically left the materials in the barn, and then when Don died, Ann and Joan put them into storage, which is great. They were there, you know. A lot of families throw things like that away, and then, you know, historians like me are just like, ah! But they didn't, and so I was able to have access to them, and those are, you know, they're in a safe place, and eventually researchers will be able to get at them. Anybody else?
Referencing the same day, that day out at Vashon, I feel so grateful that I was one of the winners who got to go. They took seven people at a time into the home. The people who lived in that home allowed us to come in seven by seven. And we got to see all the knotty pine and got to see the kitchen and got to see the pictures of her that she looked out of her window out onto the sound. It was, I have great admiration for the King County Library system as well, and especially the Vashon Library. I am so grateful to them, and I just wish they could do it again, because that was a wonderful, wonderful day.
Absolutely. So what we're talking about is that in 2001, and this was when Blanche Caffier was still alive, and her book was, you know, had been published fairly recently. There was so much interest in Betty McDonald that the Vashon librarians had this Betty McDonald Day, and many family members came. Sally, who was here, was there, and her son John, and Darcy, Chris's husband. There were lots of, and Joan was still alive at that point. She's since died, but she was there, and it was filmed. And I will tell you that the Vashon librarians, or now the Vashon Trust, is working on putting this together, and quite soon it will be a documentary that people will be able to watch that really, you know, documents that day. It's like the filming of that day. So it was great, and it was great. And the house that she's talking about is the house that Betty lived on Vashon. When I said the little house clings to the bluff, it's that house. And the woman who owns it now is a writer herself and very much values that it was Betty's house. It's rented out to somebody else, but it's in very good hands. So, anybody else?
Where does the plague and I, both the illness and the writing of the book, fall in her life? And was she debilitated from writing for a long time?
So the Plague and I happened in the late 30s. That was when the events of the Plague and I should say, when Betty was diagnosed with pulmonary tuberculosis. Tuberculosis was really, you know, a huge problem in Seattle at that time and had been actually for many years. And she was fortunate enough that she was able to go into Furlan Sanatorium where she was treated for free, and she was released in less than a year. So ultimately, it was a real success story. That would be, in terms of her life, the Egg and I happened in the late 20s. Anybody Can Do Anything starts in 1930 and includes the year in which she was treated for tuberculosis, but she just mentions it in Anybody Can Do Anything in one sentence, because The Plague and I was the second adult book she published. So when you're looking for another thing to write about, you're like, well, what do I drill down into that would be a good thing that is a rich thing to talk about? And The Plague and I, that experience was her second thing she drilled down into after her first marriage. But that's a good question. Did I answer all of it? Oh, so The Egg and I came out in 1945, and The Plague and I came out in 1948. Then Anybody Can Do Anything in 1950, and Onions in the Stew, which is her book about Vashon Island, about raising teenagers on Vashon, came out in 1955. And she died in 1958. One more question? Anybody else? Okay. Wait, David? Oh, yes. Sorry. So the question, thank you. It says right here, too, repeat the question. The question was, why are Eastern Europeans so interested in Betty? And I think the reason is that Betty's work talks about strength and adversity and family and laughter as being something that can buoy you up in hard times. And there are especially, you know, previous period, very difficult times that people in that part of the world were going through. And, you know, Betty was one of those things that got passed down from mother to son to daughter, and people read and reread her books. If there's one thing I hear from, you know, people in, you know, audiences like this, it's like, my mother loved the books, she told me to read this, and I did, and now when I'm having a hard day or I've had a horrible day at work, I come home and I read a chapter of Anybody Can Do Anything, and I laugh. And I had the experience, I've read these books so many times, I mean, I wrote a freaking biography of her, and still, when I was deciding what to read at my bookstore events, I'm going to read a little bit from some of Betty's books, I found myself laughing out loud at some of it. It's just the right kind of absurdity that I think has really long shelf life. So thank you. Thank you all for being here so much. And thank you. So spread the word. Spread the word. Tell your friends.
Thanks for streaming this episode of Speakers Forum from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Writer and historian Paula Becker spoke at the Seattle Public Library on September 10, 2016. Thank you to Linda Johns and the staff at Seattle Public Library for our recording. Tune in again soon.